You're listening to Face Off, episode 14th, recorded Sunday, April 19th, 2009. You're listening to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we like to talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us at Twitter by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow. All right, Mark. So here we are again, another week, another dollar, I guess. I don't know. We're both still kind of getting over our sickness, but feeling pretty good today. So let's dive right into it. We got some news and follow-ups we want to hit up. So the first news item that we're going to talk about is that Dell is adding encrypted hard drives to their laptops.
Encrypted SSD, solid-state drives.
Wow, all right. So why don't you tell us about this, Mark?
Well, in episode 3, we talked about a hard drive that can actually do encryption in the hardware. Full drive encryption. This is important, you know, if you've got a laptop that gets stolen or whatever. A Windows password really isn't really going to protect somebody from seeing what's data. If you've got private stuff like financial information.
I can just throw it in another computer and it'll be a second hard drive and I can browse it like any other hard drive.
Right. There's nothing stopping you. Encryption, we know, is a pretty good technology. I mean, it's pretty much unbreakable right now with current computer speed. AES 256 is what they're using here to do this. And it looks like Dell, I mean, when we talked about it in episode 3, it was kind of like a new technology. We weren't sure when they were going to start implementing it. Well, it's already implemented now in Dell solid-state drives.
So why would I want this as opposed to just using a piece of software like TrueCrypt, which does, I mean, essentially the same thing, correct?
Right. Right now, if you don't have a hard drive with this new technology, you could use something like TrueCrypt or InkFS for Linux, or I think that works in Mac too. The benefit here is the hard drive does it, so you don't need to you don't need to process it, so you're not going to waste resources on doing it.
Okay.
As much. So
much less, it uses less resources on your computer. It's a hardware device, hardware level encryption. So, you know, it's not going to slow your CPU down doing to it. All your computer knows is it's talking to a hard drive and your hard drive is doing all the encryption for you.
Right. Exactly. Okay.
So that's pretty cool because I mean, it's a really big problem that laptops are getting stolen, all over the world. And, you know, especially with netbooks, you know, it being at such a low price these days, it's really easy for anyone to get a laptop. And they're getting smaller, so it's getting really easy for someone to forget about it and leave it somewhere.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the first things someone's going to do probably is check to see what they can get off of it. If someone's going to steal, you know, something like a laptop, they're probably not going to be shy of stealing private information, too.
Oh, yeah. And so, I mean, as web developers, you know, if you're doing some contract work or even if you work at a place, you know, you might have...
Yeah,
anything from stored passwords, you know, some people I know, you know, this isn't the right way to do it, of course, but have, you know, all their username and passwords in a Word doc on their desktop or,
right.
You know, or even if you have it just stored on your computer, they could boot up with that and then just connect to, you know, all if you have like clients or something, connect all their stuff, screw it up, take whatever they want from it. So
that's a good point. Like if you have a business, you know, that you're running and you give out laptops for your employees, you should, you know, have something like this on there. And so company information, you know, it's not getting out. Maybe make it a corporate policy or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's I still am curious. I don't see like a video here or anything like that. And I'm curious to see what it actually does. So does it, what is the key? So in any encryption, you have your encrypted data and then you have some form of a key which unlocks the encrypted data.
Right.
And what I'm curious with this is what is the key? So is the key like a snapshot of the hardware in the device so that it'll only work in that laptop? Or is the key like one you input with your keyboard when it boots up?
Usually what it is part of a passphrase, like you take the passphrase and you hash it with some other data, maybe like the serial number on the drive or
something
like that. But it's going to involve the passphrase
know. Because what I want to make sure doesn't happen is that if they steal your hard drive, that it's encrypted except for if you boot it up off of the existing laptop, right? I mean, that makes no sense because then you can just crack your Windows password and then you have all the access to it anyways. Mm-hmm. If it requires some sort of passphrase before it'll even let you read the drive at all, that makes a lot more sense because then, you know, it really is secure if it gets your laptop gets stolen because no one's going to steal just a hard drive. You know, you're not gonna come over to your computer that you left at your coffee table and be like, "Oh my God, my hard drive is gone." You know, they're gonna take the whole thing. So I'm glad that it uses some sort of key phrase that the user has to input it.
Right. They're not gonna come with a pack of screwdrivers.
All right. Okay. It takes the average Starbucks 7.3 minutes to create a latte and give it to the user. Go. Yeah. So that's cool. Make sure your data is encrypted because.
And if you don't have the money right now to go out and buy a brand new netbook or whatever, you can always use something like TrueCrypt or IncFS to get this.
All right. What's the next item we got on the docket? It looks like a follow-up to the Digbar debacle that we talked about last time. So, Mark, why don't you fill us in on that?
Well, Dig actually released an article on their blog and also on Mashable. I found the link. What they're going to end up doing, it looks like, is if you're not logged into Dig, they're going to just 301, just like TinyURL and all the other ones.
Okay.
So you wouldn't see the Digbar at all. If you're logged in, you have an option to see it or not.
Okay.
So that's what they're doing. So it doesn't look like they're going to get rid of the iframe yet. They did mention they're going to look into doing some more extensions in browsers like Firefox extension, which I'm perfectly fine with.
Yeah, well, I mean, because it still doesn't really solve the problem that we talked about the content providers versus the users. So,
right.
I mean, at least if you're not logged into Dig, it will 301 you, which helps with SEO stuff. SEO stuff because, you know, the Googlebot is not logged into Dig. That works fine.
And we talked last time about the Canonical link. So they pretty much got rid of the SEO thing. That's not really the issue anymore. It's more about I don't really want an iframe on the top of my site, you know.
Yeah.
Publishers, it doesn't resolve anything for the publishers. They're still not happy with the way it is.
Yeah.
As far as the user standpoint, which there wasn't really much heat coming from the user side, but the users are going to have a little bit more options with what they can do.
Yeah,
they're going to have the option to just turn it off if they don't want it. And then if you're not logged into Dig, why would you see a Dig bar to say Dig because you couldn't log in anyway?
Yeah,
you couldn't dig anyways.
Yeah.
So they made some improvements, and I think we'll see what happens with it.
Yeah, I hope they do. I hope they can resolve this because it's just Dig is a really interesting experiment for the internet, I think. It was sort of the first social news aggregator, you know, as sort of a response to Slashdot, which was all editor-based. And they're gonna do things like this where they try new things out and people are going to have problems with it. And so I hope they can settle it out so that most, you know, especially the big content providers like we talked about, Engadget and whatnot, can be happy with the way things are and still allow Dig's, you know, throngs of users to easily find things that they enjoy and like. But
yeah, certainly.
Okay. All right, so let's get into some web apps. That's some news and follow-ups. So the first web app that we want to talk about is called Procaster, and I'm gonna let you tell us a little bit about it and tell us why it's so cool, Mark.
Sure. Before I tell you about this, let's mention to our users, if you have any news or special updates that you want to shout out to us, give an email to studio at faceoffshow or Twitter us or something.
Yes, I did forget that. That's
We do three segments. We do the news and follow-ups or errata if we made a mistake somewhere. We do web apps, and then we have our main topics, which is usually either business entrepreneurship, programming, or technology in general.
Yeah. So, yeah, as always, if you have any suggestions for any of these topics, please send us an email or Twitter us so that we can cover the stuff you want to hear.
Okay, so now on to Procaster, the web app that we're going to talk about. What it does is it's basically like a one-click broadcasting kind of deal like Ustream. The difference of it or the benefits of this one is it actually has like OpenGL and DirectX hooks so you can broadcast 3D, you know, accelerated graphics like gaming.
Mm-hmm.
You could broadcast and stream you playing a game.
And this is really interesting for me because I do run a gaming blog, and I was trying to think of ways to do interactive video. Does this support the ability to record? Do you know? Does it record in some way?
It streams for sure. Okay. Recording. Because
if it could do both at once, it would be exactly what I want. Because I would love to do some streaming gaming content for my blog, but also record it and release it, you know, as videos on the website. Because I'm trying to sort of branch out from just the text-heavy content that I have right now. But right now, the software for Procaster, you can only download in Windows. They're coming out with a Mac version soon. They proudly display that there's no spyware in their software, which is great. But this is cool because
it looks like more of like an integrated desktop app. It's not like Ustream where it's like a big flash-based deal. It comes with an app to where you can say which Windows you want broadcasted and stuff.
Yeah, so the app you have to download an app to broadcast, which makes sense if it's doing things like DirectX and OpenGL integration.
Right.
But you don't need an app to view the stream. It's just flash-based like Ustream and everything else.
Yeah, on the client side, yeah. As far as recording...
You can record. Yep, you can. It's in the bottom. It says record and play. So.
Okay. And then the other thing is like you can do like screencasts or like publish your screen if you're doing a presentation or something.
I mean you were looking. I mean this is a great way for you. You run the blog Nix Tutor, and I know you've been doing recorded screencasts, but this would be a great way for you to do
a streaming
full streaming screencasts like Q&A sessions or something like that. Yeah, I mean that would be really, really fun. Cool.
Yeah, like in an IRC channel or something, then have this running, or maybe actually it probably has a chat.
Yeah,
it does actually. I saw that. What am I thinking?
But that's really cool what it does. The big one is broadcast your games. I mean, that's a lot of things have trouble with, like DirectX or 3D things. And I'd love to.
It looks like you can mix, if you've got TV and different like video inputs, you can mix stuff real time. So that's really cool, too.
Yeah.
FireWire support, USB.
Yeah, you can actually mix to different cameras and take it off your screen and go to your camera. So. This is really cool. I'm glad you found it because I know I'm going to be playing around with it, I think, the next week, and I think you will be too, if I know you correctly. So
yeah, I mean, if you're sitting here thinking, what's the difference in this and Ustream? It's definitely going to be in the 3D acceleration recording. So for gaming, video. Go ahead.
Well, the big difference is that this is made to just to display your screen too. Usually with Ustream or anything else, they'll take any camera you have, but you have to get like a faux software camera that will display your desktop to do it in the past. And this just gets rid of that for you because it gets really hairy. I know I haven't found a really decent one. And if one of our viewers knows one of a freeware software, virtual camera in Windows that, that allows me to kind of change between physical camera sources and whatnot, I really would like to see that because we found one for the Mac, but I haven't had one for Windows. But this eliminates the need for that. You don't have to use we used Mac Cam, which allows you to put your desktop in there, but then you don't have to install any of that. You install the app and you can do it all from there.
And the screenshots look really amazing. It looks like a great user interface. So you can embed it in your site and stuff just like Ustream. So,
and I really like the name Procaster. It just catches me. Really good design on their website. I like kind of the light blue and whatnot. So give it a shot. If you follow me on Twitter and stuff, you'll probably see me doing some stuff with this in the next week or two because it looks pretty fun. I'm kind of excited.
One thing is they only have a Windows version. They don't have a Mac version yet, but it says it's coming. So
I did already say that.
Oh, you did? I missed it. Where was I? I'm sorry.
Yeah, they'll come out of the Mac. I doubt they'll ever come out with a Linux.
Did you really say that? I missed it. I'm terrible. Okay, what's the next thing?
All right, so the next thing we want to talk about is called a website called Road Sharing, which is really cool. I hesitate talking about this because I think it's cool, but it's not really prevalent in the United States right now. But what it is a social website to find other people to carpool with because in bigger places, we don't really run into this a whole lot here in Montana, but in bigger places, there's a lot of carpooling going on. So you go to roadsharing.com. You can like search for routes, and there's two ways you can post a route that you're doing already to find someone else to come in, or you can post like a requested route, and people can find you that way.
Awesome.
So what you do is there's little things like listed. There's kind of like there can be like one time routes. There can be like ongoing routes, like commuter routes, and it tells you all little things about it, like if you expect the person or if you're requesting one and you want to give money to someone to carpool with, like you can say like, here, I'm going to give money to I'm requesting one. If you're a commuter, it kind of says like, okay, well, this is kind of an ongoing one. So if you want to set up a good route that we can do every weekday, then we can do it there.
And you do like a one time one too, it looks like.
Yeah. So if you want to do like one, like if I just need a ride from the airport
for the United States, or something.
Yeah. So I mean like, and if you're looking, if let's say you're a single person and you're kind of like doing a trip or something and you want to try and see if you can sort of cut the cost down on it, you can come up here and find someone that'll, you know, you can hitch a ride with. And at least it's, you know, it's prearranged. It's not like stopping on the side of the road with some guy that might be, yeah, you know, a little shady. I mean, you're kind of, it's a little more security because you're arranging this ahead of time with someone and they're letting you know that they'll give you money for letting them hitch a ride with you.
Can you like rate their driving habits and stuff? Like this was a good commute.
That would be, I don't think you can, but that would be really cool if you could. Cause you could be like, man, this guy would not shut up the whole time. That would be me if I carpooled. People would be like, oh, he just does not shut up. He's just trying to like make awkward conversation the entire ride. So,
this is great. Like in a, you know, a recession and,
oh yeah.
I mean, last summer we had $4 a gallon gas prices. I mean, commuting is big.
Yeah. So if you also, you can click on it and view it as a map. So like right now I'm kind of zoomed in on the United States. There's not a lot in the U.S. There's a ton in Europe. This is really big in Europe right now. But, you know, like there's some in San Francisco and Phoenix and in L.A. So I hesitated putting this on here because it's not as big in the U.S. right now. But I'd like to see it because I think
it's a good idea.
It's a great idea.
I mean, this is what we talk about. We talk about Web 2.0 apps and stuff, and this is exactly. I mean, this is social. This is what we need.
Using social media to solve everyday problems.
Right.
You can't assume that if you live in a neighborhood in a place where you have a lot of people, unless you live in like a town that one company has a big plant in or something, that you're going to be able to find people to commute with every day.
Yeah, so you're going to either have to know them or you're going to have to like ask around.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as commuting goes, if someone lives like 10 minutes out of your way, that's not bad to go pick them up to commute all the way if you have to commute 2 hours after that at all. And there's no way you could do that without something like a social web app like this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
I think it's really big in Italy.
Yeah, yeah, man. Europe is much more conservative with resources than we are here. So check it out. That's called road sharing. If I ever have to carpool, I hope I have something like this that I can find someone to carpool with because I hate driving alone. So,
all right,
let's move on to the next little web app I want to talk about called TipJoy. TipJoy is a way to give people money without it lowers the barrier to give people money. So you can give people money via Twitter. You can just give people money via email. You know, like PayPal's done this forever, where it's like anyone with an email account, you can send money to. TipJoy tries to take it and make it a little less loose, saying you can give anyone money. You know, and especially with things like Twitter, we've talked a lot in the past. Things like being able to, you know, oh, I owe you a latte or I owe you a beer.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is just a way to give people money. So, like, let's say you bought me lunch one day and I knew it was about $7 because I didn't have my wallet. I could just go on here and be like, you know, give at Mark Sanborn, you know, $7. Thanks, buddy. Or I know you posted a really helpful Nick's Tutor article that saved me 3 hours of work. I can just go on there and say, well, I know you're at Mark Sanborn Twitter. Give you some money. Say, hey, thanks, dude. You saved me some money. I mean, we talk about this. You've actually made more money off your website via donations because people are happy that you saved them time than you've made off ads.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean,
people, I had no idea that was going to happen. But.
You blew my mind when you told me that too. And it's like people are saying thank you for helping me out instead of, you know, trying to click on your ad that gives you 10 cents or whatever.
Right.
They can actually just give you money and donate to it. So,
yeah, and I used the PayPal email thing like you were describing before. But I've noticed. I mean, this is cool because it's more like a, I don't know, it's easier to give.
Yeah. It's not. Yeah, PayPal, we
so
know.
So how does the Twitter thing work? When you say, does it email then afterward? Or?
What it looks like it does is you give it your Twitter information, and it logs in as you and sends a tweet out to you saying that you've got X amount of dollars and then a link to get it.
Okay.
I think so. I'm not sure. But, okay, so here is the real kicker that I want to talk to you about this. They have an API.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, with PayPal, their API consists of, here's a link.
Here's a widget.
Yeah, and this actually allows you to, like, throw in, like, Twitter hooks and flexible payment models. You can create accounts via their API, which doesn't happen a lot. You can log in. Oh, so, this is what it is. If someone has given you money via TipJoy, I totally spaced this out earlier, I'm sorry. If someone gives you money via TipJoy, you don't have to create an account to log in. You log in with your Twitter account into TipJoy, and that's how it knows how much money you have.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I logged in. I created an account because I kind of want to I'm not just receiving money. I'm going to try and use it to in a more flexible way. So I created an account, but you could also just log in with your Twitter account if you want and not have to create. You know, we talked earlier in our last episodes about what a pain and hassle it is, all these websites that make you create accounts because you're like, you just want to try it. You don't want to really commit to it too much. Well, this allows you to just log in with your Twitter account, which if people are sending you money via Twitter anyways, is what you're going to want to do so that you link your accounts together to get your money.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is something I thought about because you can, if you, anything with an API I like because it's, they're saying they, I think it's a smart business move because they say, I want you to use our service and I want you to use it in the way you want to use it. You know, not just PayPal saying, no, you can only use this widget that has a link that sends them to PayPal. This says, you know, I'm going to let you use it the way you want to and really customize it because I think APIs are important.
Yeah, for sure.
So my biggest concern with this, as we've said, or not that we've said, but we've talked about in the past, is any new thing that sort of handles your money makes me a little bit nervous.
Yeah, how secure is it?
You know, how secure is it? Like we said in the past, I mean, PayPal is kind of an institution. It's been around for a while.
Before we get into this real quick, the PayPal, I remember when I first saw, like heard about it, I was like, oh, I don't know about this place. I don't want, you know, email, send money through email and all this stuff. I was really wary about
it. Seems like it seems like a really weak bank, you know, like a bank that started up in a corner office that, you know, maybe in like an espresso shack or something like, hey, look, we're a bank. Yeah, you know, store your money in us and we'll send it out to people. And you're like,
but but now PayPal has definitely proven itself with eBay and everything else. So how about this? I mean, is it?
I don't know. I mean,
we just don't know. Is it kind of like
you just
it's like
you
the
just
new
don't
PayPal?
Know? Then again, it's not meant to like you're not gonna be you're not putting like $100,000 in this.
Right.
It's supposed to be like, you know, you see someone on Twitter that did something helpful, send them a buck, you know? And like we said, what makes this one a little bit more different is we've seen things via Twitter to send like, oh, you owe me a latte or I owe you a beer. This is a dollar amount. And if you go to the homepage, you can see some of the things that people are sending. Like this guy named Rubric gave TipJoy 50 cents.
Nice.
But Arkitsis gave some lady on Twitter named Trading Goddess 25 bucks.
Looks like you can use it to do charity events and charity widgets. They've got a Kickstarter campaign, raise money by tapping into the Twitter network.
They kind of say that they focus a lot on Twitter, and you can, it seems like, you know, they have like a bookmarklet so that you can give a tip to anyone anywhere, but it's like you can give a tip to any site you want to come on. And I think what it does then is it tries to figure out in a smart way, like what email to send it to. It's kind of shaky, but it's just a way. I mean, like we were talking about, Mark and I were actually having kind of a discussion about this last night, using small microtransactions and the power of the internet to get all those microtransactions to be something substantial. You know, if everyone who used one of your articles gave you a buck, and I mean, you can't spare a buck, you can spare a buck. If they give you a dollar, I mean, that would be substantial. That would be something.
Well,
for
and
you.
Using something like Twitter, that's a public, basically a public medium. Everybody else sees it's like a social. Value.
Exactly, it's advertising it's that like you're donating. It's,
somebody's as a person is saying you're donating, but also as a blog or something, it's like, hey, I got a dollar from this guy, I got 18 cents from this guy, I got 25 mm-hmm. bucks from this guy.
Connects you to your listeners.
Other people
a bit
are
too.
Saying, you know what? Yeah, this guy is actually helping me out. I'm going to donate too because everybody else is donating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas the PayPal is totally private. You had no idea that I was even getting money from donations.
No, I mean, no clue. And this it's cool. It kind of mixes advertising and money. And I like how they call it like a tip because it's not, I'm not paying you for services, but it's like, you know, you helped out, you know, here's a couple, you know, like just like you leave a tip, you kind of pull out your wad of cash and leave out like a couple bucks on the table, you know. And so I mean, what I'm trying to say is, you know, donate to useful things that help you out. I mean, the fact that people have been giving you money for some of your really helpful UPS articles, I think was sort of the big one that you got a lot of money for. I mean, that's great because you saved them hours and hours of work and you just donated it out of pocket because you're a nice guy.
Yeah. Now the other thing is we're seeing a lot of web apps that are using Twitter as like their whole business model.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I don't know. We've talked about this before and I personally am not comfortable with it unless it was something really simple. Like let's say You know, it's like this little thing that grabs information from Twitter and tells you some cool analytics about it. Not much work, not much going into it, not much maintenance, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Some of these people are making serious businesses around Twitter, and that scares me because then you are not in control of a very core component of your business. If Twitter changes, you know, because right now they're having trouble trying to figure out how they're going to monetize. If all of a sudden they say, like, all right, well, you can't log into Twitter unless everyone gives a $25 one-time registration fee. There's your whole business model right out the window. Right. I mean, you know, it makes me nervous. Little dinky things maybe, but I would not start a serious organization purely around Twitter. I would try to integrate it as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, they could integrate this in other mediums. I mean, they're doing Twitter, but right now it looks like they're like hardcore Twitter.
Well, they're focusing on Twitter. You can add the bookmark, like you said, to give a tip to anybody, and I'm not sure how it figures out who to send that to, but yeah, they're really focusing around Twitter, and I don't think I just would put all my eggs in that one basket like that.
I agree.
I don't know. I mean, it's cool. I think Twitter has definitely revolutionized the way I've thought about a lot of stuff in the past, you know, year or two at least. But it hasn't gotten to that sort of institution of the internet phase yet, you know? Like, Yahoo is an institution of the internet. It's been around forever. They do their thing. I mean, it's not always the best, but they've been around. Google is an institution of the internet. Twitter, I don't think, is there yet because they're in this sort of shaky phase of they don't have a really extensible business model. Who knows what they're going to do? And they have a really finicky user base that, you know, when Twitter goes down for like a whole day, the internet shrieks as like a collective, you know, cry of hate. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I wouldn't do it.
All right. So let's talk about the next web app we got. I think it's Do Ink, but you could also say Doink. I don't know.
Yeah, so like the logo looks like it is Do Ink, and the top says Do Ink, but when I first read it, I said Doink. So that clever.
Both sounds fine.
Yeah.
Basically, so what this is a way to collaborate and make like animation videos of cartoons or it doesn't have to be a cartoon. It could be for your business or anything you wanted it to be. It looks pretty straightforward. You know, you draw with their built-in tools and you create animations.
Yeah, it's really simple. Like you import a picture. If you watch the tutorial videos, which I suggest everyone do, like the simple animation tutorial video is like you bring in your little cartoon and you like say, okay, I want to create a path. And you like click on him and you click and like drag and hold to make the path. And then you go to the bottom and you extend it to like 5 seconds and then you hit play and it's like a little animation cool. Follows the path. It was
so
dead
you can
simple.
upload like it was a GIF and ping and
well what they animated that time was an animation that they had built in the thing already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they made like a simple 5-frame animation of a guy walking. It was just a guy and like the animation was basically his legs wiggling back and forth so it looks like he's walking. And they took that animation and imported it into their overall animation. So it was pretty cool. I'm assuming you could import stuff.
But, I mean, you could almost use this to make something for, like, a website. I don't know, like a flat, like a flash, not an advertisement, but for, like, an attention getter or something.
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah, maybe something. I thought it would be clever to, like, try and do a goofy kind of video of, like, a cartoon. And then you can, like, explain a service in a...
Yeah.
You know, in layman's terms, kind of a goofy cartoon.
Kind of like what Google did with Chrome when they first came out with Chrome. They had like a comic storybook about Chrome. You could maybe make an animation about your service or your blog, you know, something like that. Or, you know, you can also play around with it and just have fun.
Yeah, I was really drawn to this because it seemed like a really, video kind of scares me. I don't know, scares isn't the right word, but a lot of people have said, hey, are you and Mark going to do any video stuff anytime soon? Like, you know, and I immediately cringe in my mind because video seems really hard to me, especially like animation and things like, and, you know, motion graphics and stuff seem really hard to me. So I'm kind of like,
it's intimidating.
Yeah. But when I saw this, I was like, well, I can do that. I mean, I can do that. I can click and drag a dude.
They make it incredibly simple to use.
Yeah, and I think if you were clever with this, you could make it not so cartoony and not so goofy. Like you said, if you could import images, you know, import like a real background, import like a real picture that you made transparent, and you know, or like you said, it doesn't have to be an animation of things or of people. It could be of things. It could be your logo you know, swooping into the middle and then, you know, glowing or something. You know, yeah, you could like do that really easily.
Like an intention getter for your website or something.
Really easy.
Or like the Google, you know, do an animation describing a product or a feature.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So check it out. It's really simple to use, really fun. It kind of fits in that sort of like sumo paint category that we're talking about, like mm-hmm. these web apps that are doing what I think are pretty advanced things on the web, which is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. All right, Mark, that does it for web apps. Again, I want to remind our listeners that if you guys have any web apps that you want us to check out or any cool new applications that you'd like us to talk about on the show, even if it's your own, we'll give you an honest and unbiased review. But go ahead and submit those. Send it to studio@faceoffshow.com or send it to either Mark or I or Faceoff Show on Twitter. And yep. We'll take a look at it and talk about it on the show. We're always excited to especially interact with with people that are listening with the show, especially if they're working on something. I'd love to hear from them. So,
and now we'll move it on to our main topic segment.
All right. So the first, it's funny, our whole topic segment this time is kind of centered around pro blogger.
Pro blogger, yeah. Two major ones.
Yeah. So the first one I want to talk about it was an article I saw on Pro Blogger a while ago, which is there are many ways to build a successful blog is the title of the article. You can get to the link in the show notes.
What is pro? I mean, we mentioned pro blogger.
Oh man, this is gonna be a mouthful with that. If we have to keep saying that.
We mentioned them a little bit before. Pro Blogger. If you're new to blogs, you gotta check out Pro Blogger. He's probably the authority on blogging.
Yeah,
he's got one of the largest sites there is on how to blog, how to be successful at running a blog, and being successful doesn't necessarily mean making a bunch of money on ads. There's some blogs that don't even have ads, but it doesn't matter. It's all about making your blog, getting your information out there, and he's really good at that.
It's more about getting more readers that are interested in your content, mm-hmm. not just getting more readers. I mean, you don't want to dumb it down.
And
or,
making
you know,
your content better. I mean, some people really just don't know how to write. They write great. Like, they have good grammar, good spelling, mm-hmm. but they don't know how to make, you know,
shoot themselves in the foot.
Well, like we talked about, the scannable content and making web readable traffic.
Exactly.
Content.
Yeah, it's a tough crowd out there on the internet, and they have like a half a second attention span, and if you don't grab it, they're gone. It doesn't matter how well you're writing if they don't think that they want to read it when they first get there, they don't. So,
and some of this is not necessarily blog specific, even though it's you know pro blogger about blogs. It actually relates to websites in general.
Yeah, so it's a great site, problogger.net.
All right, now on to the topic of Pro Blogger.
Okay, so the thing that caught me about this article is they have kind of a bunch of topics that are highly debatable things about in the blog, and I thought we just kind of would go through each one and hash our thoughts about what we think. So. The first one is RSS feeds, full versus partial feeds. What do you think, Mark?
I've seen both. I used to do partial on marksanborn.net, and I realized, you know, what's the point of having a feed if it's not full?
Okay.
So I'm a fan of full feeds. A lot of people say don't put ads in feeds at all. I'm okay with ads in the feed. I don't know if we're going to get into that part of it.
No, go ahead. That's part of the feeds. That's part of your topic.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I think one ad maybe at the top or the bottom is fine. And full feeds is my take on it. What do you think?
See, I think I don't know. It's tough. It depends on the blog. I think if you have a really, really long post, I prefer partial because I don't want to read in my RSS reader. I kind of use my RSS aggregator as just a way to filter content that I really want to dig down into. I gloss over everything, and if something's short and interesting, I'll read it on there. But if it's long, I don't like reading it in Google Reader, so I pop it out to their website.
Hmm.
Plus, I think a lot of the identity of a website goes into its design and its ambiance, and that gets lost in the RSS reader.
Hmm.
But then again, like you said, if you're having like just short articles, like if it's three paragraphs, I don't want to have a read more after the first paragraph and click on it and get two more paragraphs.
Right,
that's ridiculous. So I think you have to, you know, use it wisely. If you have like a really long article, especially if your long article is the one you're trying to really bring eyes to your site to maybe get some ad revenue, shorten that. But if it's just like a little news clip or something like that, don't partial that because that just gets frustrating.
Yeah, that's some interesting points that you brought up that I didn't really think about. See, when I was thinking about it, I was like, why would somebody subscribe if they they're not getting all the content? You know, if you're it's like a newsletter and you're getting for the first paragraph of every article, what's the point of subscribing? Why not just, I mean, I guess you're getting an alert to what new topics are coming out. But I was kind of like, you should probably be able to see the full article in text.
Yeah, there
is, well, kind of what my take was.
Some websites do it really smart. They say partial content, no ads.
Really?
Okay, so if you find what you like, you click on it and you go to their website with the ads, or full content but ads in the reader. And that makes sense.
That's
too. That's a clever idea, because that way, you know, someone like me, I don't want, it's not an issue of ads. I just want to see the titles and see which ones I want to read, so I can scan through it and then go out to the ones. But someone like you, who thinks that you know, should have the full content, can do that and choose to have ads in their reader too.
But it's kind of weird that I'm like the one you described, when actually, when I see a topic that I really like, I actually click on it because I want to see the design. I want to see it, how the author saw it and how the author put it together. You know, I don't want to, I want to be able to scan it actually.
Yeah. I mean, some RSS stuff gets goofy too. Like, it doesn't show all the formatting the way it is in the original post and whatnot. So,
and then sometimes I want to see the full, because I want to be able to scan through the full content and see if it's worth clicking on going to it. You know,
that makes sense.
So there, it's definitely can go both ways on that one.
Yeah.
So I can see why that would be a debatable.
Yeah. Topic. No, these all are pretty debatable. It was funny because I first read the article, I guess, to bring it back to the beginning. I first read the article and I went through each one of these, you know, and I said, why is that a question? It's obviously, you know, partial feeds. Why is that a question? You know, and then I got done. I thought, well, no, you know, there are two sides to every coin, and these are not set in stone. I mean, especially if pro blogger is saying that they're debatable, he would know. I'm sorry, I'm not a pro blogger.
I mean, he does polls all the time, and these are probably all... came from his polls where there was split decision.
Yeah, exactly.
So the next one is comment sections.
Yeah, so comments versus no comments.
I am a huge fan of comments. I actually prefer blogs that have comments over blogs that don't have comments. And I'll take it even further that I don't really prefer a blog where I have to sign in to leave a comment. I want to just throw in my email address, name, and my comment.
Yep.
I don't care if you got a moderator or do whatever you got to do, but I don't want to sign in to do that.
Well,
so, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I've thought about this. I agree. I think comments are great. The only part is it can be disheartening to a viewer when they go, or to a blogger when they go to their site and see no comments.
True.
It seems really like, ugh. But
I've seen a lot of tips for blogging when you start off and you don't have very many comments. You just totally disable them for the first 6 months. Until you've got about 100 subscribers, and then you add comments.
Yeah,
I've heard that tip.
Maybe,
but I don't know. I'm overall, you should probably go with comments.
I agree. I think it's it engages the reader more than just, you know, I'm staring at your page,
and it gives you feedback. If you're, you know, writing something that's totally wrong, you're gonna know about it in the comments.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so I say comments. I think that's not, I personally don't think that's very debatable. But you got to pay attention to it. You got to make sure that people aren't running off in your comment section about things that are really debatable or not professional. You know, you got to watch spam, of course. If you have WordPress, make sure you have like a Kismet on so that you don't get spammed, or, you know, you just don't want people spouting off idiotic stuff. So you have to watch it. You got to keep track of it.
I remember mentioning it in an earlier podcast that, I am very ruthless when it comes to like negative comments. I just delete them unless it provides, you know, if it says, oh, this tip is wrong because of this, then that's fine. I'll put it on there because that's his, you know, but if it's just negative and it provides no value to the article, I just delete them.
Yeah.
Or if it's spam or something like that.
Okay. So the next one is post frequency, post more versus post less. What do you think?
This is definitely a debatable one. I kind of don't like blogs that post more than once a day. I'm a once a day guy or less.
Yeah. We've talked about this, the different style of sort of RSS reading. There is sort of the headline style, which is, you know, I use Google's homepage, iGoogle, as an example, where it'll pull like the, you know, last 10 from a thing and just display them on the homepage. I don't have to read each individual one. They don't sit around as unread if I don't. And I just scan the headlines really quick and see which ones I want to read. And then there's sort of the email model of RSS reading, where you know, it pulls each article. Each article is considered unread until you read it, and you go through each one and mark them as read. You know, like a great one, Engadget or
Even Gizmodo is starting to post about twice a day.
Yeah. And so those are good headline ones where you just see kind of the last ones that are popping up. I mean, I agree. I don't want to get spammed. I hate logging into Google Reader and seeing that I have, you know, 2,000 unread items.
Right. I mean, yeah, for the people that use RSS kind of like an email, like these are the articles I don't want to miss, you know, it's overwhelming to have you just checked it and then you come back an hour later and you got 10 more articles to read. Yeah. It's like, when will it stop?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you're like, I can never catch up, you know? So,
but then you use it kind of like you use it, like you just scan through everything, 2000, you know, I don't know. I guess there's a limit at some point.
Yeah, there was, oh man, there was like, it was either an app or a web app a long time ago I saw where you added all your RSS feeds to it and it like laid it out like a newspaper. I mean, it was really newspapers. Like there was, you know, a headline and then like a little snippet of the article and you could click to go read the other one. But it was the same thing. Like, you know, each one wasn't unread. It just kind of mushed them all together into a newspaper format. I'll have to look for that because
that's cool. Yeah.
That's perfect for things like, I mean, I like Engadget and Gizmodo. I like the articles they write. I just don't want to read every single one and mark every single one of them as read. And I don't want to take 300 of them and mark them all as read without reading them because I'm afraid I will miss the one thing that I really care about and is important, you know?
I don't know. There's something about when, if it's posted more than once, it's like loses a little bit of its value for me. I don't know why.
Well, there's just some websites that are hip, fresh, hot, and new. You know, like they're getting stuff all day long and pumping it out. That's fine. It comes down to personal style. And then there's sites where, I mean, like I think your NetTuts or your Nix Tutor site is a great example. Those are very well thought out posts with one continuous thought that need to be long and sort of, you know, take you step by step through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. If you posted more than one or even maybe just one article a day on that website, it would kind of lose its prestige of being, this is a site where you get high quality content that is prepared ahead of time. You're not Linux Journal. You're not, you know, oh, this new little thing came out. Here you go. This little thing, you know, throwing it out all the time. You're, you know, it just depends on your style. Mm-hmm. Montana Fragfest, the one I'm doing, I'm trying to kind of create a mixed style. I'd like to have, you know, I'd like to post maybe three times a week where, you know, on Mondays I would have like kind of a well thought out post. And then Wednesdays I would kind of do maybe a short little Dinkmeyer post and then Friday another one. But I'm not sure how that's working out or whatnot. But
yeah, I've definitely noticed in the blogging world, I guess, if you post, whatever you choose, you need to stick with it and be consistent. That
exactly.
is the biggest thing. If you're going to post three times a week, that's fine. Mm-hmm. If you're only going to post once a week, that's fine. Whatever you do, don't post every single day for a week and then don't post for a month. Don't do that.
I think like
I'm a victim. I've done that before. Yeah. It's bad. You got to stay away.
I think a great example is sort of like NetTuts and VectorTuts. They do, you know, really well thought out long tutorials that are, you know, very prepared. And then recently, like you said, they've just started shooting out little things all the time.
Well, they're starting to get multiple authors. Well, I mean, they've had it for a while, but they've got multiple authors, and so they can just pump posts out. And they've got submissions coming in all the time as well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's starting to dilute
five if you got five articles, they're not doing this quite yet. I mean, they one or two a day now. But I mean, if they start to get to the point where they got like five tutorials, you're going to feel overwhelmed a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. And it sort of dilutes their property. Like before, if you got like one a day, you're like, this is the one good one that I'm ready for the day. But if they start pumping out five, even if the quality of them didn't decrease, you just feel like it's, you know, each one is less important now because they're pumping out more and more and more. All right, so let's talk about the next one is domain names. Long versus short, hyphens versus non-hyphens, .com versus other extensions, local versus global domain extensions. What are your thoughts on this?
I would first say that .com is the most powerful domain, and I'm going to say
hands down.
No hyphens, shorter, 1 to 2 word style thing, like a Nix Tutor, like a NetTuts, even ProBlogger, you know, 1 to 2 words, nothing really long. No, I would stay away from hyphens.
Hyphens are a difficult one.
At the same
one,
time,
I
would say with new URLs like, you know, Cligs and Trim and Domainer, that mm-hmm. app we talked about, there's people are getting used to having all kinds of extensions.
Yeah, I don't know. Like we talked about with Domainer, I'm still hesitant to have a domain that you can't say and people can't understand easily.
True.
Like the company is called Domainer. We call them Domainer, but that doesn't tell me how to get to their website. It's domain.ner.
Right.
You know,
and you have to kind of say that. Or
yeah,
that,
exactly. Or Cligs is another one. You know, we say Cligs, but no one, what are people going to do if I say go to Cligs? They're going to go Cligs.com.
Exactly.
That's the first thing you do.
So .com is the best. If you can either afford it or you can be the first one to get it, .com is the best.
Yeah. Or I can say you can use other .com or other, you know, dot domains if you do it correctly. Like, you know, something dot me. I mean, that, you know, jaderobbins.name, that's not a .com, but to me, I think that's just as powerful because I can say it and it means sense. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think
I
you really need
not
to be careful
quite
about
as
splitting
powerful as jaderobbins.com.
Oh, exactly. It's not.
It's up there.
I guess I'm saying verbally, I think it's just as powerful because I'm saying go to jaderobbins.name and they'll be like, okay, jaderobbins.name. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I say go to j.ri/INS, you know, like we talked about with Domainer.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why .com is more powerful is if somebody sees your logo and they're like, oh, like NixTutor. It's how do I get to NixTutor? The first thing they're going to try is NixTutor.com.
Yep.
You know, exactly. That's why it's more powerful than the other ones.
I agree.
It's just the more common one, and that's my thoughts on those.
Yeah, and just whatever you do, I mean, like you said, you basically eliminated 90% of the domains out there by saying short, you know, two words, .com.
They're probably all taken.
Yeah, a lot of them are. But just be smart about it and don't, you know, make sure you can verbalize it easily. I mean, that's another one. Uh-huh. You know, you can say the address easily. People can understand it from what you're saying.
And go with .com if you can.
Go with .com
can't.
If you can. .net's getting more acceptable.
Right.
.org, no, unless you're an organization. Like, yeah. I feel weird about that. But, you know, the rest, if it's not .com, make sure you can verbalize it easily. Mm-hmm. Like, jaderobbins.us. You know, that makes sense. Not
even Trim, you're like, Trim, how do I get to trim.com? You know, people make mistakes on that.
Yeah, exactly. So be careful. But as simple as possible and easily verbalized, you don't want to confuse people because, especially, I mean, you know, net savvy guys like you and I can figure it out pretty easily, but average Joe consumer does not. They know pretty much .net, .com, .org, .edu, maybe. That's it. All right, so the next one is hosting. Hosted or self-hosted?
Now, I'm not sure if they mean do like a WordPress, your own WordPress or blogger.com style.
Yeah, yeah, they're saying like...
Or you have a server in your basement. And you're hosting your website off the server in your basement.
I'm pretty sure they're talking about like pro blogger versus installing your own copy of WordPress.
Okay. Or that, you mean not pro blogger, you mean blogger.com.
I mean blogger.com.
Or WordPress.com.
WordPress.com.
What's some of the other Blogspot.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Things like LiveJournal, things like that.
I would, hands down, self-hosted would be the best.
I agree. It's more expensive.
Even if you're new to blogging, I would still say if it's something you're now, if you're not sure if you want to blog, try the other ones first. But if you're like, I want to get into this blogging thing, hands down, don't even think about Blogspot or Blogger. Mm. Just go get WordPress, buy a host and install it.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of successful blogs out there that are run on those systems. You know, and ones like WordPress.com give you enough flexibility that you could still put AdSense on them and get ads.
Yeah, but if
it just, it, none, I know what you're saying. It looks,
there are
it
some
feels
successful.
Unprofessional to you to say something.wordpress.com.
Right.
You, I mean, especially you want your own domain and you don't want like the wordpress.com banner at the top if you're trying to go full hardcore into it. But honestly, if your core competency is just blogging, nothing really value added. And especially I would say if it's your own personal thing, like you go ahead and do it. But be aware that later on, you're probably going to want to move away.
Well, yeah, if you want to start adding a forum or, you know,
yeah.
Have a, you know, if you want to start a, like NetTuts had a network of sites, Envato yeah. or whatever, It's not going to be very easy to do on Blogspot or WordPress hosted sites.
Yeah. But then again, I mean, think about it. If you got dug and you got Reddited and stumbled upon in the same day, I mean, it can be expensive if you blow up. And these other ways are a way to, if you want to get out a lot of really popular cheap content, you could do it via them.
One of the advantages of going with Blogger is you're automatically approved for AdSense, and you also get a little bit of SEO page rank by being on blogger.com.
Yeah, exactly.
Not a whole lot, but you do get some.
I would say if this is like a side business, like something you don't think you're going to take all the way, or maybe eventually try and, you know, push into something, its own spinoff thing, go ahead. Just understand that you might really have to explain to your readers later that you're moving to your own address.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one, titles. Do you do descriptive titles or titles designed to get you keyword searches?
I do both. The other thing I would mention with the titles is for my article pages, I don't use my blog name in it at all. It's only the title name.
Really?
Yep.
Why is
that? I found huge, huge SEO advantages of doing that.
Really?
Yep.
Huh. So I like descriptive titles. I hate cookie cutter SEO titles. I think they're stupid. I think they bore readers. Especially in the tone of voice I'm trying to get on Montana Fragfest, you know, very humorous, very different. It seemed ridiculous for me to be like, to have these just boring, boring titles. It doesn't fit my style at all.
Right.
So one way I've kind of got around that, as we talked about this before, is make sure you tag and categorize your stuff on your blog correctly. Tags are great because you can just put as many as you want that are relevant. Again, relevant.
Yeah.
But I don't know. To me, I would rather sacrifice the SEO advantage to have content that I'm proud of and I feel is consistent with my voice.
Yeah, what I try to do is I try to make a descriptive title, that has keywords in it. But it's always favored in the descriptive title.
Yeah,
I don't just make up keywords to throw in a title.
Yeah, you know? Or like I use sort of subtitles a lot. Like, you know, if I'm talking about TF2, I could be like destroying the scout or weighing in on the heavy was one of my articles, and then it's like colon. How to defeat the heavy as a scout.
A lot. I mean, I've seen a lot of tips on using tools like Word Tracker and keyword analytics and stuff to figure out which titles are going to bring in the most traffic. Because a lot of times you're thinking, well, I'm going to use this title because it's got a lot of keywords. But oftentimes a lot of keywords, there's a lot of competition.
Yep.
For that particular article title.
Yeah.
If you choose maybe a little bit off the path, the beaten path, that article, you won't have as many people, but you'll be like number one.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so if anybody ever uses those exact words in that certain title phrase, they're going to come to your site every time.
Yeah.
Almost 100% of the time. So I don't know, but I would go definitely descriptive more than the keywords.
Yeah. I don't know. And it just depends on your voice too. I mean, if you are running a really dry professional website, like let's say on finance, and you're not trying to be humorous or anything like that, it makes sense to be very to be very straightforward keywords as to what's in each article. You know, how to maximize your Roth IRA's, you know, return on investment.
Right.
Very straightforward. You know, you don't want get more money on your pile. You know, if that's not your voice of your blog, it makes more sense. But I think that there's other ways to benefit SEO-wise than to do, you know, to have such boring titles. I think, and especially your consistent readers, your subscribers, will definitely prefer your descriptive titles more because they will fit your voice and seem much more active. Okay, so content, link content versus original content.
I'm going to say original content's better.
Oh, yeah.
I would not be afraid to link to people.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what it's referring to? Or they're talking about posts that are nothing but links?
Well,
or a post that's like a paragraph long and then it links to the actual post.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, if you see like a lot of video game ones especially, or even like Lifehacker, you know, they're like so-and-so at this website found out this cool way to do it, and they quote it and then link to it. And that's the whole Lifehacker article is basically a quote. And a
the link. Only thing that bugs me about that is that Lifehacker article will get dug and the other one won't.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is really annoying, yeah. I think, because then I got to click through two sites to get to it, and then the original author doesn't get the dig credit.
Yeah, I think if you're going to do leaked content, you need to tag on original content with it. It shouldn't just be a rehash of some other stuff, because like you said, yeah, Lifehacker is going to get dug, and it's like, well, great, that'll bring some traffic to the original creator's website, but not as much as if they were the article dug in the first place. And it's like, that's...
Right. The only time I think it's okay to just do link content is if you have a mashup of different types of links in one post.
Yeah.
Like all of the best links or something.
You know,
or,
top 10 something something.
Yeah, top 10 something, then you have the 10 different ways to do the certain thing.
Yeah, where you're... that's great.
A compilation of...
A compilation of links. And also... You need to make sure, I don't know, it's, there are so many apps out there that are designed to get you to get links. You know, Delicious, Dig, Reddit. I think there should be just more original content out there in general because...
A lot of times you need
to think about it.
It's like top 10 or 10 ways to do this, and there's like 20 ways to do this, and it's all just referring to the same article, and then some guy will do 40 ways to get, or 40 different links to get these links, and it's just like this spider effect of
duplicate
content.
And like you said, I think you should not be afraid to link at all in your post in context at all. I think that's great. That's the best way to do it. But make sure you add some extra stuff onto it so that both the person who originally made the content gets some credit for it, and you're not just stealing what they said.
Uh-huh.
So, all right, design. Professional design versus templates.
I would say do your own design if you can. I mean, obviously not everyone's a designer. If you're really serious about it, you're going to have to get a design, whether you pay for it or you're going to have to learn yourself to do it yourself. I would say templates are not going to work for you if you want to go big. If you're just doing a quick little blog, you know, don't plan on getting big, but you want to, you know, 100 or 200 subscribers, you don't probably need a professional template. You can get away with something that's already out there. If you're going to do it, though, don't go to WordPress and say top 10 templates, because everyone else is going to have that same template. Go find something a little bit more obscure.
Yeah, we need to redo the Face-Off Show template because we get burnt by that once in a while. I feel so dirty when I go to someone else's website and see, you know, of course, in my head, I think of it as my template, but there's thousands of blogs out there with that template. But
yeah, ours is a little bit of a lack of time. We haven't worked on it, but we are going to make our own design.
Heck
for
yes, it's going to happen. All right. I agree completely. It can be difficult for some people, but at least if you do get a template, edit it. Try and manipulate it yourself.
Yeah, that's the other thing you can do too. MarkSandmore.net is edited, so it doesn't look too bad.
No.
Because I took a template and then I've made all kinds of changes to it. So it doesn't really look too bad.
Yeah, and like some of the biggest things you notice in template are if they have identical headers, identical backgrounds. So I mean, do things like change the color scheme, the CSS a little bit, change the background if you can. You know, try and, you know, obviously if it has just a stock picture as the header, get that out of there, put your own in there. And that's a way to get a template that when people come to your website, they won't immediately recognize it as that stock template that they've seen on WordPress million
times. That's about the worst thing you can do is not only just get a template, but get the template and don't take any changes to it. Like, I notice a lot of people use Drupal. They'll use the same
that
template.
That default Drupal, yep.
I'm like out of there as fast as I can get out of there.
Yeah, exactly.
Huge
hack
turn
it
off.
Up.
Huge turnoff. Don't do that.
No. So maybe we should practice what we preach and try and make some time for a template this week. But okay, I agree. That's a good one. Ownership. Use social media versus build your own properties.
I'm not sure. So,
like,
building your own community, like your forums and stuff, rather than submitting to Dig.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what they're saying. Like, or like, you know, user submissions versus just hacking out your own content. Like, here's a great example. I would like to mix it up for Montana Frankfest. I would love for people to submit gaming articles to Montana Frankfest. Love it. Like, this is great, actually. Like, Vector Tuts or Net Tuts, they use all social content. People submit to them.
Oh, okay.
It's not just them hacking out their own content. But at the same time, I think there should be this sort of anchor of content of me, the community voice pumping it out at the same time.
Yeah, NetTest has, I think he does like one or two articles a week, and all the other ones are all social articles that he doesn't write.
Yeah.
But he, I mean, he doesn't have time to write them all. He's got like 10 different sites he's running. So
I don't know. I'd like to see a mix. I'm kind of wary about the pure social model, especially for a blog, because it's like, well, and you can't just start out that way. It doesn't seem to work. You can't just say, all right, people, give me stuff.
No.
And everyone will do it right away.
He did all the articles at first.
Yeah, and it seems like you kind of have to ease into that. I don't see anything wrong with it, especially when we talk about, like, trying to spread your name out. So, like, doing guest blog articles on other people's stuff. It's essentially doing that, but all the time.
Yeah.
So it'd be great to get your name out. Like, let's say, you know, if I could get an article on a big gaming blog somewhere, it'd bring some traffic to my website, and maybe I should think about doing that. But
okay, how about the topic, niche or broad topics?
Oh, this is tough.
I would say both. I don't know.
It just depends on what you're really interested in. Let's say you are really, really, really interested in massively multiplayer online RPGs. You can start a blog about that, which is kind of niche, you know. But let's say you can dig even further. There are tons of World of Warcraft, a very popular massively multiplayer online RPG out there. It just depends on what you think you can get content on. I think I started Montana Frankfest a little too broad. I did all gaming. Yeah. And the more I do it, the more I realized I wasn't super interested in everything in gaming, like massively multiplayer online RPGs. I'm not interested. I'm sorry.
Yeah, MarkSanborn.net was a total conglomeration of all kinds of different things, what I was doing, and it just wasn't working. So I had to drill down a little bit, and I did niche.
Yeah.
I ended up going out.
Yeah, and I think unless you have like a good community of people ready to write with you to cover a broad topic, if you're trying to do broad and you can't fully do it 100%, it just looks kind of weak. Like, okay, well, like, honestly, if you look at Montana Fragfest, it looks weak. It looks very weak because it's supposed to be a gaming website, and I've pretty much only written content about Team Fortress 2 and, you know, silly gaming things I find. It looks really weak.
Yeah, the problem with...
You have to have dedication to do broad.
And then, the only... On the flip side, with the niche, if you pick something too small, you run out of ideas or run out of... Or you don't have very many... possible listeners.
Yeah, you could lose interest in your niche that you started writing for originally. Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a place for all of them. I think right now the broad ones are a little more difficult to get into because there's a lot of broad topics that are pretty saturated with big players right now. Mm-hmm. But you know, you can start niche and expand and get broader as your audience and your staff grows. Also, I don't know. Dating posts, dates on posts versus non-dated. I'm just gonna hit this. I think you need to date everything. I don't care about time, but I think there needs to be a date on everything because you need to know whether or not information is relevant or not.
Yeah, and also, I mean, as a user that comes in and sees something that doesn't have a date, and he's going through the article and he says, "Oh, that's what's this is wrong. This is wrong. This is wrong. I'm gonna comment it. I'm not gonna trust this author anymore. He's not credible." Well, if the author would have had a date that said 2006, the user might say, "Oh, okay, this is understandable. This guy wrote it back then."
Yeah, you know? You're ridiculous. The new version of Ubuntu has no problems with that. And you're like, "Well, this is written 4 versions ago, but you didn't date it."
Yeah, I'm gonna go with dates on this one too.
Yeah, I think that's clear. I think it's stupid not to date stuff. Even if you have timeless content, you might as well date it to let people know when you wrote this timeless content. I mean, like, unless you're talking about dating or something, you know, that doesn't really change from year to year versions of software.
There's some, I don't know, I could see the other side too.
I wish I could upgrade my wife's firmware.
I can think of a post in mind that is kind of timeless, yet when you go look at it, it's like spoiled eggs or something. You're like, this was written 3 years ago. But yeah. I don't know. There's books that have been written 50 years and hundreds of years ago, and they're still good.
And if you're a good blogger, if it is really that timeless and good, you should go back and write a follow up to it, and then link to that in your original one.
That's true too.
You know, so like saying like, "Hey, you know, I know this is old, but come check out this new kind of thing that I did for it." Okay, anonymous blogging versus using your name.
I'm going to go with using your name. Be transparent. Be who you are. You might as well brand your name along with your blog.
I agree.
That's what I'm going to go with.
I agree. I mean, I can see purposes for anonymous blogging. Like, let's say if you're doing something highly, even possibly illegal, like if you want to do a blog about how to pirate music or something. I don't know. You know,
the only other thing too is you want to kind of hide the fact that you have multiple authors. Like NetTuts could have done that.
Yeah.
And could have had submissions coming in, and it might look like it's just NetTuts putting out this content. You
it's
know?
True. And strengthens, there's different ways their brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I would just say for the most part, username.
Yeah, I would.
Let people know who you are. I mean, this is the kind of the age of transparency. And if you have something to say, you shouldn't be embarrassed or hide it at all. You should just put it out there and be yourself.
Yeah. And if you make a mistake or you're wrong, then go and correct it, add an update, add a post, whatever.
All right. SEO, writing for search engines or writing for human content for humans?
I'm always going to say humans because the search engines are always going to improve and they're going to go their own way. You know, they're going to the minute you write for SEO, you know, a year later, they're going to change it. And it's, yeah. I don't know.
Or, you know, I mean, I've seen spam blogs that are purely written for SEO, and that is not useful in any way, shape or form.
No.
You'll
never beat it.
Yeah. Search engine's job is to interpret websites and rank them so that they are useful to humans.
To humans, right. So in an ideal world, in a perfect world, the search engine's always going to return the most relevant, most popular articles.
They will look at it like, you know, they emulate exactly, in the perfect world, they emulate exactly how a human would look at it and say whether or not it's relevant.
Exactly.
So, yeah, right for humans.
So I would go with humans. I would
Don't shoot yourself in the foot, though, with SEO. No.
There's some golden rules with SEO. There's some things that you can just totally screw up your site and lose all page rank, but I would say most of SEO is just writing good pages, you know.
Yeah.
I would be concerned about SEO. I would research it a little bit, but I would definitely not go overboard and start writing content just for SEO. I wouldn't page rank or keyword analyze your copy, you know. I would just write.
Just put out good content because, like we said, you know, search engines' jobs are to find relevant content for humans. So they should be shifting, not you. All right. So last one, personal blogging, sticking to the topic versus injecting personality and personal details. I'm going to say I like injecting personality and personal details because, I mean, I don't know. There's some people that don't like this, but I think I'm a pretty unique person, you know, happy flowers and stuff like that. Yeah, you're unique. But I want people to I don't want to have to feel like I'm not being myself. The whole point of this for me is to share Jade Robbins as the world. I mean, we call it Face Off Show, but really it's Jade Robbins and Mark Sanborn talking like we do when we sit on the couch and just, you know, shoot the breeze normally. But other people can hear. And I like that. I think that I think I'm what makes it different. I could, you know, I could send it through 20 editors and have it come out as an academic paper, but I've read a lot of academic papers that are really not interesting or fun at all. And I personally try and make everything as fun and exciting as possible. So
I would, yeah, I agree 100% on that. Yeah. I would not just stick to topic every time, all the time.
No. And I mean, what I found, especially when I was going to college, was that the most effective teachers for me were the ones that talked about their personal experience. I mean, if I had a couple teachers that you can tell went straight for their MBA out of their bachelor's and have had no relevant experience in the real world. And it was very dry, very academic. Then I had a couple teachers, you know, one who like did some consulting for Nike and stuff like that. And he had the best stories to hammer his points home because he was talking about what actually happened. You know, so one time where he didn't prepare for a meeting and it just blew up in his face. And you're like, okay, so that's what it does actually happen. If I don't prepare for my meetings, they will blow up in my face. That's useful. Not just, you know, like a lot of, I always joke, but a lot of computer scientists at Montana State University, anyways, in the CS department have to take a lot of high level math. And then they graduate and go get like, just programming jobs that don't require that sort of high-level math. And I feel that that really dry academic thing is kind of like that. It's like, well, you don't need it. Let's stick to what will be useful to you.
I think it also allows you, if you're doing a broad topic and stuff, it gives you more personality to your posts. It makes your posts a little bit more unique. People understand you instead of just your content. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps build your community.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely seen a lot of the most successful magazine writers and stuff like that are the people that reflected personally on themselves and what happened and really integrated themselves into their writing. Any robot can spit out just plain text, But what makes it really engaging for people is relating to that person and having personality to it. Even if it's like a dry, you know, I think Ben Stein is a great one. Anything he puts his personality into is great because he has like this kind of funny joke, dry academic personality. Mm-hmm. But you know that that's what's funny about it. Uh-huh. And it makes it fun. So I agree.
I would say don't go too overboard, though. Don't be blogging about what you did on the weekend the whole time. And
yeah, I mean, it has to be relevant. Like, you know, it's not MySpace.
No.
So, all right. Again, if anybody out there, if any of our listeners have any topics that they'd like us to discuss, you know, as long as it relates to web technology, we're game to try and tackle it and see what we can do with it. So,
or share your personal details. Say you lost the podcast and you're mad and you
know. As we saw last week, things can happen. So
yeah, just get whatever you want to share with us, just send it on to studio at faceoffshow.com or give us a shout out on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, say, oh, you guys, you didn't include my name in the last podcast or, you know, whatever. We don't just shoot us a line.
Yeah. Well, that about wraps it up, Mark, for this episode of Face Off Show. Again, I'd like to remind everybody they can subscribe by going to faceoffshow.com/feed. If you have suggestions or comments, email us studio@faceoffshow.com or reply to us on Twitter. We're at Face Off Show, or leave a comment on our website about each episode. So we'd love to hear from anybody. If you have any, like we said, Mark and I are not perfect. So if we screwed something up, let us know and we'll try and fix it and make it right and let the world know that, you know, we made a boo-boo. So thanks, guys, and we'll see you next week.